go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join the madness.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 664. Today we have a question from Robert that we have been terribly negligent about. We actually recorded this 2 months ago, and we had a malfunction on one of the channels, and the episode was so good, we wanted to re-record half of it. But unfortunately, it accidentally got deleted. So we're doing it again, and hopefully it'll be half as good as it was last time, and if you enjoy this half as much as we enjoyed doing it, then we will have enjoyed it twice as much as you. So today, Robert asks,
"The cover for my first novel was self-made. It's not shocking, but it isn't good enough. When I look to replace it and to purchase new covers, what should I be looking for? I understand you can either arrange art and have someone finish the layout, or have someone do both. Obviously, there are genre trends that make sense to emulate, but when it comes to the art, how do we know what is of good quality? For example, with epic fantasy, a painted look is common, and rendered spaceships for sci-fi. Positioning of elements in the work and how the art will fit the dimensions of a character all go to the overall impact. And that is before one even gets to the quality of the work. How can I make sure my new covers do their jobs?"
So this is a big one. Fortunately, we have Kitty on the podcast, who is the guru here with this. I play second fiddle to her in this department. But I'll start with the basic research and approaches. The basic research is look at the top sellers in your genre that aren't big names through traditional publishing. If they are big names through traditional publishing, it doesn't matter how crappy their covers are, they're selling on name recognition.
And by big names, we do mean big names, not names that you have heard, that you know of because you are a writer and you go to writer conventions and the like and whatnot.
Right.
Because you and Dan and me all know authors that we think are big because they're bigger than us, but they're not necessarily big names to the general book-buying public.
Right. By big names, we're talking about the people whose names would be recognized by people who aren't fans of that genre. People like, in science fiction, people like Asimov, Heinlein, Clark, Bradbury, Orwell, stuff like that. In thrillers, we're talking about Patterson and Clancy, Kuntz, Stephen Kuntz, not Dean Kuntz. Lee Child, people like that. In historical fiction, we're talking about, like, Clavell and Follett and Woke. Danielle Steele in soap opera. Nora Roberts in romance. Those are big names. Yeah, so big names for real, not just big names because you happen to be swimming in those waters. So you want to look at those covers and see if you can spot any trends. And the trick is, and this is a hard trick to nail, even if you're really good at it, it's a hard trick to nail. The trick is to make something that will, at the same time, communicate to the audience, this is what you're looking for, and this is special and unique. As Nathan Lowell says, you don't want to be a big fish in a small pond, you want to be a big toad in a small pond, because all the fish notice that the toad is not a fish, but he's still in that pond. Gail Carriger's first cover for Solus did this spectacularly well. And those of us who were in her friends group when this happened to her, including, if I remember correctly, her first response, were all rather horrified at the cover. Not because of the artwork, but because the titling was basically ripped off from the Marie Antoinette movie, which flopped the summer before her book came out. But whoever it was that made the decision to take that shot of Donna holding the parasol from a steampunk fashion website, I think it was, that they licensed it from, and pair that with the desaturated background of Trafalgar Square, came up with a striking look that communicated both the general steampunkiness, the general romance noveliness of it, the sort of Jules Verne, Sherlock Holmes era sensibilities, and the notion that maybe there's a werewolf lurking back in the fog somewhere. It was brilliant. It looked exactly like the genres it was blending, but it looked like nothing else there. That's ideally the kind of thing you're looking for. If you can't get there, because there is an element of lightning striking with brilliant breakthroughs like that that set trends, a similar idea was the cover for Jurassic Park. That set a whole trend. It was completely unique at the time, but communicated to its audience. Stepping back from the notion that you can set a trend, which is hard to do, you want to get something that looks of a piece with what else is in the genre and yet still stands out, looks like itself, rather than simply like, me too. That's the trick. Once you break down what kind of look that is that you're going for, and you figured out how to tie it to the book so that it looks like itself and it's not just a generic spaceship or whatnot, at that point...
You get into stuff like font choices and cover layout and whatnot.
Right, and you have to decide whether you're going to start with the typography or with the art.
Yes, we've done it both ways, and honestly, that's one of those things that depends on the genre, because there are some genres where the typography is kind of front and center. There are others where the art is more central and you just need to make sure that your art has room for the typography. The typography is going to be important for any cover because it will communicate a lot about the type of book it is, from the choice of what kind of font to use to how large the font is to how large the title is in relation to the cover art and in relation to the font for the author and all those sorts of things. And I can't give you any rules on this genre needs this, this, and this, and this genre needs this, this, and this. It's one of those things that...
It does evolve over time.
It does evolve, and you should look at the last 5 years of top sellers in whatever genre you want to market your book as.
That said, one of the things we've noticed with designing either from artwork or from typography is that it usually works better if you're designing a series to design from typography.
Yes. If you are doing a series, you want to design the series look, and you may have some artwork that you really want to design from, but the problem with starting from the artwork on a series is you don't know if you're going to find or be able to recreate artwork that's of a similar style and design unless you have your art department in-house and you are making your photographs and making your art.
Or you're strapping Kitty down to a desk with a coffee IV and forcing her to do digital paintings.
Oh, what a terrible thing. I would do all digital paintings if I didn't have to do anything else to make money.
Yeah, if you're doing a series, you want to go from typography. The series looks that we started from artwork, we have all retired on our in-house stuff. And when we do client work for a series, we always start with the typography layout. Because we've found that it's not just that it's hard to duplicate the artwork going forward, duplicate the field, though it can be, especially if the piece is sufficiently unique. It's also that when the artwork is dominating the design considerations, the market isn't. This was a very hard lesson for me to learn. Because it's a marketing tool, you have to sort of bow to the expectations of the market, because you need a look that will communicate at a single glance at 6 feet away. That's the rule, which is about the same size as you see your thumbnails on Amazon. If it's a single book, if it's a standalone, like for me, The Resurrection Junket and Down from 10, if it's a standalone, then designing from the artwork can be really fantastic. You can get something beautiful and something striking that really stands out. You make the artwork your centerpiece and make it an expression of the story that also communicates the genre. But if you're doing a series, I would highly recommend starting with the typography and working out from there.
And for series, I would also recommend framing the artwork with the typography in a sense. We're not just placing the typography in a certain spot. Sometimes we are, but we're designing a frame that is going to stay consistent. And I think our Clark Lantham covers and our Suave Rob covers are the best example. Also the Cobra Con covers, which you've got on your website, even though they're not available yet.
The first couple ones are on the website, although they're not available yet. Yeah, the typographical elements do a few different things. They communicate the genre, they communicate information, i.e. they tell you what the title and the author and the series, etc. are. But they also serve as your governors for the visual flow over the page, and you want the eye to gravitate eventually toward the bottom right corner to induce people to turn the page. It's a real subtle psychological trick, but it is very important. Now, in some genres or for some kinds of artwork, you can get away with not quite doing that if you're fixing the attention so firmly on the middle of the page that you're inducing the customer's eyes to try to bore through and see what's inside. That accomplishes the same thing. But what you don't want is people's eyes being drawn right to the top, people's eyes being drawn over to the left, because we read the other way. We read left to right, and we read out in. And so you want to move the customer's eyes in those directions with the typography.
Kind of implicit in this question is, how do I find artwork if I'm not the one making it myself?
So,
hire me.
Yeah, hire us. There's a few categorical lines implicit in what you're saying that you want to maybe do away with. The medium of creation doesn't matter. It's the look that matters. It doesn't matter if someone is using Photoshop or Illustrator or a digital painting or a physical painting that they're photographing or they're retouching existing photographs or whatnot. There's no such thing as a Photoshop job versus a painting job versus whatnot. It's what it looks like. I know artists who can, with 2D handwork in pencil and colored pens, duplicate the look of a 3D rendered spaceship. The means don't matter. What matters is the final look. And that's important when you're shopping around for artists, because you want to shop by look, not by tool.
And the only exception for that is if you want them to provide you the artwork in the raw medium, such as if they're working from Photoshop, you don't want the JPEG, you want the Photoshop file, or you want the XCF if you're working in GIMP.
Yeah, and not many artists will give that to you anyway.
Yeah, and not many artists will give that to you. But so that's the only exception to not being specific about tools. But, you know, you can import a PS file into a
general data maintenance protocol. You want to work in universally interchangeable file formats. You don't want to work in stuff that's tethered to a platform. So you want to be working in TIFF, JPEG, and PNG, and SVG. You don't want to be working in AI and PSD and XCF if you can avoid it. Because those latter formats are tethered to specific software packages instead of being open standards. So the specific software packages can write and read those all day, every day of the week. But if you ever have to move from one platform to another, and we have moved platforms about 6 times over the course of our association so far.
We've been pretty stable for about a decade.
Yeah. The reason we've been stable for a decade is that we deliberately moved to open formats only. And that saved us from what used to be a major stop-the-whole-business operation for a couple of months while we convert the files up to the next thing. So that's an important consideration, too. It's also the reason that I don't like or didn't like Scrivener. I understand they've moved to HTML for their sources, so I haven't looked at them again yet. But I don't like Microsoft Word because it's not open formats. If I'm working in Word because I have to, I will read and write out the formats to ODT or XML so that I always have control of my data, because I've lost things due to a lack of ability to translate, and I will not let that happen again. Sorry for the discursion, but yeah, look at the look of the art. Don't worry about the tools. And now where to find
this
art.
Is something that's a little bit up in the air right now. A few years ago, I would have told you where to find artists. DeviantArt and a few other places like that. One of the problems with the art landscape is that a lot of new and upcoming artists are finally wrapping their brains around copyright and terms of service. And they are leaving places like DeviantArt and Tumblr and whatnot in droves because they're not comfortable with the terms of service.
TOS constitute a copyright grab in a lot of places.
Right. Like, I have an account on DeviantArt so that I can comment and interact with other people, but I have never put any of my own artwork on there because of the terms of service. I've never felt comfortable with that. One thing you can do is look for art that you like and see if you can contact the artist. Most publishers will publish the copyright information of the artist, so you will be able to find their name, look for them, Google them, find out who they are, find out what their website, and contact them.
Another way is to pull sources from the Creative Commons, make sure it's properly licensed, but pull pieces and sources from the Creative Commons and put them together yourself. You can license stock imagery from any of the major stock sites, although Getty has particularly onerous terms and you have to be very careful about adhering to the licenses. Make friends, engage in favor trades. So with all of that, you also ask about the quality of the work. How do you judge the quality of the work? Well, there's...
The most important thing on the quality of the work is really that it communicates to the reader the expectations of what they will find in the book accurately. And that doesn't mean that the figure character needs to look exactly like you imagine the character to be, just that it needs to be vaguely the same age and race and look like a person and show as much of the person as is expected for the genre, which can vary a lot. And weirdly, there are some genres that have really weird...
Yeah, no, let's see, there's
the ass
genre. There's the back of the head genre. There's the team of people underneath the big glowering face genre.
And then there's the back genre, or the headless back. It's not necessarily the ass so much as it's a headless female body.
Middle of the neck down to the waist.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's all back on genre expectations. We're talking about quality. How can you tell the work is good quality? Well,
do you like it?
That's less important. I mean, that was one of the things I had to get over, because I'm classically trained in the arts. And so I had to get over, did I like it, and develop a new aesthetic. You do want something that looks like it isn't... buttoned together and pasted together, unless you're going for something that looks pasted together like South Park or something. Whoever your artist is, they need to know how to blend the layers to make it look like it's all of a piece. And if something is standing out so that it's not of a piece, they need to be doing that in a way that looks proper rather than looks put together with glue and Funtac. I can explain to you on a technical level what I mean, but I don't know if it would carry any weight. We're talking about things like transfer modes, light wrap. There's tools you use to do these things. You can learn about them in compositing documentaries on the Star Wars DVDs, frankly, which is where my education got started way, way, way back when I was learning visual effects. And, of course, light and shadow should always... You should have the light lines all make sense. You know, you don't want things looking like bad Russian propaganda photos, or the shadow lines are all different between people standing next to each other. Haven't you ever looked at old Soviet-era propaganda photos?
No, I've seen their propaganda posters.
There was some amazing artwork came out of the Soviet propaganda machine. It's very, very strange that they did such wonderful, realistic artwork and such crap at everything else. But, quality, it should look like it was done by a professional. And if your eye isn't well trained enough to tell, there's no shame in that. I mean, you're a writer, not an artist. Then you want to maybe solicit the opinion of someone who is, just to get a second set of eyes. But that's about it. I think that covers the whole thing. Yeah. Rights. Suppose we ought to talk about rights. When you're doing a cover, if you want the copyright to the image, you're going to pay for it.
Right.
Or you've got a really dumb artist and you should take advantage of them.
Yes.
But,
no, you shouldn't take advantage of the artist. No. No. Wait. Don't.
This is business person versus artist person talking here. What you're doing technically is you're buying a license to artwork that they're doing design work for hire on top of. If you want the artwork for merch, you're going to have to pay license fees, or you're going to have to pay a lot more up front. Or, like I said, you've got either a dumb artist or a young and hungry artist who doesn't understand what they're up to. Either way, you want to make sure those terms are laid out securely in the contract, because if you presume you have those rights and they're not explicitly transferred, they can sue you, and they can recover a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa, if you do have those rights explicitly transferred and they start selling merch, you want to be able to go after them for it. So make sure you've got your rights situation sorted out in paper explicitly so you know exactly what's going on and so do they. And I think that covers the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that does.
Thank you very much for the question, Robert. Good luck on your cover art hunt. And we'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.